G'day, listeners. You are listening to the Natives Rouseabout podcast. I'm your host, Michael, and today Trent will be joining me to discuss the importance of Charles Pearson and to review the introduction and first chapter of his fantastic work, National Life and Character. How are you going, Trent?
Oh, I'm well, thank you. How about yourself, Michael?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. A little cold down here in Melbourne. It's been a bit of a chilly winter.
Yeah, same. I'm freezing up here in Brisbane. It's
Yeah.
way too cold.
That's all right. Oh well, just chuck the blankets on and have a nice, nice toasty hot chocolate or something, and pull through, I suppose. Yeah. All right. Well, why don't we just jump into what we're going to talk about today? Yeah. Look, we'll read a lot of Pearson's book today, or a lot of chapter one at least. But I wanted to start. Even before we get to the listener comments, the famous ending of chapter one of National Life and Character, which really shows how prophetic Pearson was, how powerful his writing could be. And some of the historical importance of this is actually the section that our first Prime Minister, Edmund Barton, read out in the debates on the White Australia policy, those being the Immigration Restriction Bill and the Pacific Islander Labourers Bill. And during the debates, he actually held a copy of this book in his hand. And the section he read, quote, "The day will come, and perhaps is not far distant, when the European observer will look round to see the globe girdled with a continuous zone of the black and yellow races, no longer too weak for aggression or under tutelage, but independent, or practically so, in government, monopolizing the trade of their own regions and circumscribing the industry of the European. When Chinamen and the nations of Hindustan, the states of Central and South America, by that time predominantly Indian, and it may be African nations of the Congo and the Zambezi under a dominant caste of foreign rulers, are represented by fleets in the European seas, invited to international conferences, and welcomed as allies in the quarrels of the civilized world. The citizens of these countries will then be taken up into the social relations of the white races, will throng the English turf or the salons of Paris, and will be admitted to intermarriage. It is idle to say that if all this should come to pass, our pride of place will not be humiliated. We were struggling among ourselves for supremacy in a world which we thought of as destined to belong to the Aryan races and to the Christian faith, to the letters and arts and charm of social manners which we have inherited from the best times of the past. We shall wake to find ourselves elbowed and hustled, and perhaps even thrust aside by peoples whom we looked down upon as servile and thought of as bound always to minister to our needs. The solitary consolation will be that the changes have been inevitable." Yeah, so that is the famous ending section of chapter one, read out. I think it was a bit abbreviated, but read out by Edmund Barton in those debates around the importance of why we need to have the White Australia policy brought in, immigration restriction, repatriation of foreigners already in the country. But what do you think of this section, Trent?
Oh, bleak. It's very bleak when you read that, and a lot of it has really come to pass. Like we're living in the future that he envisioned.
Yeah, even just, the idea of monopolizing trade in their own regions and Australia's trade having become, dominated by China and Japan and all of that. And
Yes.
you're right about the pessimistic view. It kind of reminded me, I'm a Spengler, not in terms of the philosophy or anything like that, but just the pessimistic attitude of inevitable decline that cannot be stopped, and you just got to have that sort of stoic, stiff upper lip of the Brit.
Yes. Yeah, I don't know if I would agree that our decline has been inevitable or necessary, but he obviously seems to think so.
Yeah, I mean, the politicians of the time obviously took action to try and prevent it. Barton, of course, as we mentioned, but we'll also see that it was influential in U.S. politics. It was read and reviewed by President Theodore Roosevelt. I think Barton might have even gifted him his copy, and it kind of set up a genre of writing that was taken up by the two famous U.S. authors on this topic, Madison Grant. With his 1916 book, The Passing of the Great Race. So he was definitely influenced by Pearson. And then obviously writing in that tradition, Lothrop Stoddard with The Rising Tide of Colour Against White World Supremacy. But to some extent, it sort of starts here with Pearson in Australia. So yeah, that's a little taste of what we're going to look at today. But why don't we just go through the next couple of sections first, the listener comments. So I think this was from the last episode. We had Plank 4973. He said, "G'day guys, it would be great to get a nativist geopolitics slash foreign policy episode. How do we as Australians balance our nationalism with our need for Daddy America in the Asian century? Do you guys believe we can get away with true independence and sovereignty? What are the implications of the several potential future timelines on our cultural and national development?" So first of all, thanks for the great question, Plank. And we can definitely discuss this perhaps again in a future episode, but I just want to point out before we say anything today that we have already discussed this topic a fair bit towards the end of the John Lawson guest episode called Alternate Media and Entryism. And in that episode, we went through our member Elias Priestley's article, The Need for a Nativist Multipolar Future, which can be found in the National Observer, and discussed some of the ideas from that article. But Trent, any brief thoughts on this one?
First thought, I do believe that Australia can achieve true independence and sovereignty. I don't think we're anywhere near that position right now. And it's something that we as a nation have been neglecting for well over 50 years now. But if I was to like steal a phrase from the gym bros, there's a lot of newbie gains that could be made in this avenue, and Australia could really achieve greater levels of sovereignty with some pretty minimal effort. So that's my response to that, the thrust of that question.
Yeah, I mean, in my view, look, we have such a defensible position as a island continent that we totally control under one state. The real threat has always been for Australia, the enemy within, the importation of or importing of foreign elements into the country that then pose a threat, as we'll discuss today with Pearson. So yeah, I think if we manage to sort out our internal problems, then a defense will not be too problematic. But yeah, it is tricky. It is tricky because it is a matter of having enough population and enough production. And this would be going well off track to discuss this in full length, but part of the populate or perish idea that which led to the kind of gradual opening of the White Australia policy, first to, Southern Europeans and then to others, was this idea that we needed to expand the population if we were going to. We were going to survive. Obviously, that after the experience of World War II, there was increased paranoia about that. So, and yeah, well, look, we can discuss this another time, but yeah, it should be possible. All right, other listener comments. Old Mate 1788, which is a great name, said great show, so short and to the point. And we also had some nice feedback along the same lines from Mick G. Okay, so that is all the listener comments done. Let's move on to the poetry segment. And obviously, since we're talking about Pearson, I have picked a brief Pearson poem, which is not so much to do with necessarily with politics or with the race issue, any of that. It's sort of illustrative of the time he was writing in the latter part of the 19th century. And yeah, you had this increase of secularism, the impact of Charles Darwin's views. So, sort of orthodox Christian views and dogmas were being pushed into the background, and there was rising, at the time, it was called free thought. And to some extent, I think, Darwin, the impact of natural pressures on populations and so on, a lot of that would go on to inform the thesis in National Life and Character in the first chapter. So it is re in a roundabout way relevant. But this poem is called In Galilee and expresses his sort of not quite orthodox Christian views. So In Galilee. In Galilee, unknown and strangely, said the voice that cried, "Arise and follow me." Yet they that heard felt their hearts burn within them at the word and followed, lightly casting life aside. Severed from all old memories, as the bride leaves home behind her, entering her Lord's gate, these twain accepted that incarnate fate. Prophet or dreamer, crowned or crucified, not theirs to question was the voice divine. not theirs to linger where their lives lay planned. He speaks and passes on, nor other sign doth God accord but understood command. Follow me to the death, nor other call shall break our rest till the last darkness fall. So that was In Galilee by Charles Pearson. And in all honesty, it's not really to my taste, but it seemed fitting to give his poem a chance, given that we're talking about him. What did you think of this one, Trent?
Yeah, I'm with you on this one. Not to my taste either. I am a real novice when it comes to poetry. But it didn't really have a nice rhythm, which is what I like look for in a poem. So not my cup of tea.
It's a it's illustrative of Pearson himself in a sense. He was born to a clergyman. His father was a clergyman, I believe, of the Church of England. But he himself eventually sort of again moved away and got involved in that free thought versus Christianity. And clearly from the poem, he's a religious man, but prophet or dreamer, crowned or crucified, not theirs to question. Was the voice divine? Clearly a bit of skepticism as to whether Jesus was incarnate God or was he just an influential character, and he had the whole historical Jesus wars going on in the 19th century, and every second influential thinker was inventing a different concept of Jesus. So kind of in that context, we'll have to talk a bit about the Big Book Arcade in Melbourne at some stage, because sorry, this total tangent. The guy who did that was a very influential atheist free thinker. Coles Book Arcade, very influential. Let's move on. So brief Pearson biography. So yes, he was born in 1830 to an Anglican clergyman, John Norman Pearson, received a very good British education, ending up at Oxford, where he was eventually made a fellow of Oriel College. And then between 1855 and 1864, he was professor of modern history at King's College. So he would be taking this sort of historical approach to his book. So this forms the foundation of his learning that would lead to his dire predictions in the great book National Life and Character. So definitely a solidly British and imperial man. He only arrives in Victoria in 1871 at the age of 41, and Victoria was really the colony where he was most influential. But he had been to Australia a bit earlier in the 60s, in South Australia, where he intended to build a sheep run. But that endeavour was a failure due to a terrible drought that hit the colony. So really only when he gets to Victoria that he becomes influential. He works in education, the sort of early establishment of the University of Melbourne, and I believe it was the Presbyterian Ladies' College that he also worked at. Very progressive sort of mentality of his time. He was for women's rights, the reform of land ownership, and so on. But look, I don't want to talk about his life for too long because I don't think it's, to be honest, all that interesting. But really, it kind of does raise a question, I suppose, given the back and forth between Australia and England, plus his other wide travels, because he did travel around the world quite a lot. To what extent is this book, National Life and Character, a particularly Australian book? Because obviously, it is a British imperial book, and he received his formative education in England. But to kind of give us a preliminary response to this, I'll quote from a contemporary response to the book from the London Athenaeum. And they said, "His view is not purely or mainly European, nor does he regard the inferior races as hopelessly beaten in the struggle with Western civilization. The reader can indeed discern that Mr. Pearson's point of view is not London or Paris, but Melbourne. He regards the march of affairs from the Australian point of view. And next to Australia, what he seems to see most clearly is the growth of the Chinese power and of the native populations of Africa. In this forecast, in fact, Europe loses altogether the precedence it has always enjoyed." Was there anything you wanted to add on his biography or standpoint, Trent?
The only thing that I found of note in his biography was that he had a lifelong struggle with his health, and he suffered from pluralism, which I had to look up what that is. But it's kind of like asbestosis, you know,
Okay, yeah.
that like choking disease you see people have, where they have to carry around the oxygen tank with them. And as we'll see in some of his writings, I think his health struggles may have influenced some of his views on where people are able to survive and the white man's ability to live close to the equator.
Yeah,
That
no.
was the only thing of note that I picked up on that you didn't cover.
Yeah, no, I think that is an interesting point because yeah, the environmental suitability for Europeans is definitely a big point in the book. But yeah, look, let's just jump into looking very briefly at the introduction of the text, and then we can get into chapter one. So I do plan, by the way, listeners, to read extensively from Pearson himself. Because I think it's well worth hearing the ideas from the horse's mouth rather than just my interpretation. But look, introduction, we won't go into too much, but in general terms, it's about the discussion of the difficulties of predicting the future, many errors of prediction that were made. He gives a whole ton of examples of errors made by different statesmen and so on. But I've got a quote here, which I think is illustrative again of that point made by the London Athenaeum of his standpoint. And this is what he has to say. Quote, 20 years' residence under the Southern Cross has forced me to consider a new side of this particular question, whether the capacity of European races to form new homes for themselves is not narrowly limited by climate and by the circumstances of prior population. Australia is an unexampled instance of a great continent that has been left for the first civilized people that found it to take and occupy. The natives have died out as we approached. There have been no complications with foreign powers, and the climate of the south is magnificent. Nevertheless, it is still a question whether the white race can ever be so acclimatized as to live and labor in the northern parts. And it seems certain that neither Englishman nor German can ever colonize New Guinea. The fear of Chinese immigration, which the Australian democracy cherishes and which Englishmen at home find it hard to understand, is in fact the instinct of self-preservation quickened by experience. We know that coloured and white labour cannot exist side by side. We are well aware that China can swamp us with a single year's surplus of population. And we know that if national existence is sacrificed to the working of a few mines and sugar plantations, it is not the Englishmen in Australia alone, but the whole civilised world that will be the losers. Transform the northern half of our continent into a Natal, with 13 out of 14 belonging to an inferior race, and the southern half will speedily approximate to the condition of a Cape colony, where the whites are indeed a masterful minority, but still only as one in four. We are guarding the last part of the world in which the higher races can live and increase freely for the higher civilization. We are denying the yellow race nothing but what it can find in the home of its birth or in the countries like the Indian archipelago, where the white man can never live except as an exotic. End quote. So, yeah, I think that's full of many of the points which we have already discussed. But, Trent, anything that you want to take away from this bit?
Not too much. I've spent a bit of time living and working up in Cairns, and the climate up there is not for the faint of heart. So I do see that he has a point.
Yeah, look, it was a big question at the time of white Australia and even Federation. The Queenslanders were afraid of losing coloured labour. Even, I believe, thinking to my ANA history, the ANA branches or chapters in Queensland were not fully sold on white Australia because of this perpetual question of who's going to do our work in the tropics. So, yeah, unfortunate. Yeah, look, I think the only other thing to point out there is the parallel he draws with South Africa, and that'll be quite important in chapter one. He discusses that a lot, and he was again very perceptive and prescient on the course it would take there. All right, so next little section, and this is the last section from the introduction. Quote, so. He's talking about the issue of population growth within suitable territories. Sorry. So, quote, either the growth of population will be arrested, as in France, or the state will have to concern itself much more actively than English economists will like with the organization of labor. Now, the history of the English colonies in Australia and New Zealand is particularly instructive because it shows what the English race naturally attempts when it is freed from the limitations of English tradition. The settlers of Victoria, and to a great extent of the other colonies, have been men who carried with them the English theory of government. to circumscribe the action of the state as much as possible, to free commerce and production from all legal restrictions, and to leave every man to shift for himself with the faintest possible regard for those who fell by the way. Often against their own will, the colonists have ended by a system of state centralization that rivals whatever is attempted in the most bureaucratic countries of the continent. The state employees are an important element of the population. The state builds railways, founds and maintains schools, tries to regulate the wages and hours of labor, protects native industry, settles the population on the land, and is beginning to organize systems of state insurance. End quote. Yeah, so this section relates less to chapter one and to more to the latter part of this book, which we won't discuss today. But he's talking here, obviously, about the liberal or libertarian tendency of the English colonists, nonetheless giving way to state centralization and power under the influence of managing a growing population, preventing class conflict, and so on. And if we think again, what are those policies that belong to the Australia settlement or the Deaconite settlement? It is, well, I won't list all of them, but the one that's relevant, state paternalism. So that sort of more bureaucratic socialist aspect to the state control. Anything that you want to say on this point, Trent?
Nothing to add on that.
Yeah, all I would add is that it's worth mentioning. So yeah, this Pearson is coming from the liberal tradition himself. So when he came to Victoria, he's very much a free trader, and only really the strong influence of David Syme, of I believe the Age, who was David Syme being very influential on Alfred Deakin as well. It was really Syme's protectionism that turned Victoria into the protectionist kind of state. And yeah, Pearson, to the extent that he wanted to get involved in politics and have patronage, he sort of had to accustom himself to that protectionism. So yeah, I mean, it's coming out of this colonial lib style liberalism. And yeah, we don't often associate, I suppose, liberalism or progressivism with, immigration restriction, racial thinking, and so on. But it is worth pointing out that, it wasn't the Labor Party that really created White Australia. Despite the Labor Party having White Australia as its central plank, they had to work with the liberal parties, the protectionists, the free traders, and there was a liberal side or a liberal argument for immigration restriction in White Australia, which was going, all the way to John Stuart Mill, the need for a homogeneous population to make representative democracy work, and that sort of thing. So, yeah, we're kind of balancing out the laborism today by talking a bit about this colonial style liberalism that is, I suppose, the angle that Pearson's book takes. All right, so let's move into chapter one then. And this was originally a standalone article that was adapted into the book. It's the most influential part of the book when we're talking about the impact on politics. And so it's definitely worth being the focus of this episode. So he starts off with giving general background assumptions to which he's responding and which he regards as erroneous. So these are the assumptions he's responding to. Quote, "No one, of course, assumes that the Aryan race, to use a convenient term, can stamp out or starve out all their rivals on the face of the earth. It is self-evident that the Chinese, the Japanese, the Hindus, if we may apply this general term to the various natives of India, and the African Negro are too numerous and sturdy to be extirpated. It is against the fashion of modern humanity to wish that they should suffer decrease or oppression. What is assumed is that the first three of these races will remain stationary within their present limits, while the Negro will contribute an industrial population to the states which England and Germany will build up along the Congo or the Zambezi. The white man in these parts of the world is to be the planter, the mine owner, the manufacturer, the merchant, and the leading employer under all these, contributing energy and capital to the new countries, while the Negro is to be the field hand, the common miner, and the factory operative. Here and there, in exceptional districts, the white man will predominate in numbers, but everywhere he will govern and direct in virtue of a higher intelligence and a more resolute will." Trent?
We're striking back on that like we were talking about with the Queenslanders and their desire for cheap labor, that is, who's going to do this work for me? They want to be the planner, the mine owner, and the manufacturer, but don't necessarily want to do the work in the fields, which is the beginning of the end,
Yeah, that's right.
as we've learned. But very, very forward thinking of Pearson to pick this up so long ago.
Yeah, that's right, because the perpetual assumption of these people that he's talking about is always that, look, we're going to be fine. We're going to use the coloured labour. We'll still be in charge. Nothing bad is going to happen to us. We're just going to make a profit and all will trundle along nicely. And of course, Pearson is going to come in with this much more pessimistic, but of course, from hindsight, from our standpoint, realistic point of view, which is that, as soon as you open the floodgates of the labor, you won't be in charge in the in the final situation when you're no longer one in four or whatever, but you're one in 16, one in 20, whatever it may be. There's no way that you are going to have control over all these people.
Yeah, well, in this at the end of the paragraph where he's describing the planner, mine owner, manufacturer, the field hand, down to the factory operative, the what he's sketching out is the Hindu Varna caste system, where you have this stratified class system of people, and it's pretty obvious the type of civilization that this system produces. Cheap labor is a civilization destroyer. If I just want to hammer that point home.
Yeah, spot on. Yeah, so generally, what is he saying here? There's a general tendency at his time to assume that the whites are going to, remain in control based on their racial superiority, their higher intelligence, and more resolute will. And he goes on to say, if we ask on what these calculations are based, we shall probably be referred to the experience of the past in America and Australia. In Canada and the United States, the red man is little more than a memory. The Carib has practically disappeared from the West India Islands. In the Argentine Confederation, the Indians are a powerless minority, and the number of European immigrants to that country and to South Brazil seems likely to increase year by year. In Australasia and in the islands of the Pacific, where Europeans have settled or where they trade much, the Maori, the Kanaka, and the Papuan are dying out. We cannot close our eyes to the fact that certain weak races, even when, like the Kanaka, they possess some very high qualities, seem to wither away at mere contact with the European. So I think that's all pretty self-evident. If we continue a little further on, he says, it will be noticed that these evanescent races, different as they are in many respects, have two features in common: that they have never been very powerful numerically, and that they have never been able to settle down in any steady way to industry. It is probably safe to say that the Chinaman, the Hindu, and the Negro are in no danger of anything like the fate that overtook the Aborigines of the New World at the hands of a foreign conqueror. A compact nation of 400 million may be endangered by revolts like that of the Taipings or that of the Mohammedans of Yunnan, for in both those cases, the war waged was one of extermination, but has little to dread from a civilized power except temporary humiliation or tribute. End quote. Yeah, so he's prescient here, of course, in predicting China's rise. And we have to remember that at this point, China's practically completely subjugated by various imperial powers. If they hadn't already lost in Korea to the Japanese, they would do soon. I can't quite remember my timeline in terms of Asian warfare and politics and so on. But yeah, we have to remember that, they'd suffered humiliations in the Opium Wars. They'd been addicted to opium, based on English mercantile interests and so on. So to imagine that this nation would then rise to be the number two, or even perhaps going on to be the number one world superpower, you'd really have to, have this different perspective that Pearson is coming from compared to most people of his time. Anything else you want to say?
The century of humiliation is over. That's it. That's what that paragraph said to me.
Yeah, that's right. And one other thing we can take out here is he's pointing. I don't think he would consider a weakness. I wouldn't necessarily consider it a weakness either. But that, these calculations are, when it comes to the Chinese, are based on the idea of like wars of extermination. Like, oh well, we could just wipe out the Chinese or the Indians and just exterminate them all. But really, even at this time, which modern leftists would consider highly racist, and obviously Pearson's writing in highly racialized terms, openly talking about superiority, inferiority, evanescent races, and so forth, that most people today would cringe at unless they sort of come from our perspective, I suppose. But even in those times, like, there was no real taste for exterminating people or genociding people. So I think that's an important point to take out there, because that's why he
Well,
says.
that's in conflict with the sort of mainstream narrative that there was this sort of genocidal white supremacist patriarchy just on the march across the globe. It really wasn't true.
Yeah, look, of course there were, events of violence, and races did suffer greatly. The Tasmanian Aborigines were basically extirpated. But on the whole, I think outside of those evanescent races that he talks about, yeah, there wasn't really a taste to go around and try and wipe everyone else out that wasn't white. So I think that's an important point to take out there. All right then, moving on. He returns to what he started in the introduction with, this parallel of South Africa. And so he says, quote, "The case of Natal is more instructive for what may be expected in Africa generally. Natal was seized by the British in 1842. The Boers who had occupied it, and to whom it was valuable for its seaboard, being a mere handful of men among natives who accepted them for the moment as deliverers from the Zulus. Nevertheless, the number of black inhabitants at that time, though great in comparison with the Dutch, was so inconsiderable as to be only 5 to the square mile. Nevertheless, in 1891, nearly 50 years after its first settlement, Natal has only 36,000 Europeans out of 481,000 settlers, the remainder being chiefly Zulus, though partly Hindus and Chinamen. The lower races have nearly doubled in proportion since 1863, when 1/7 of the population was European. The reasons of this are not far to seek. British rule means order and peace, industry and trade, and the enjoyment of property under fairly equal laws. To the African native, the establishment of a colony like Natal is like throwing open the gates of paradise. He streams in, offering his cheap, though not very regular, labour, and supplying all his own wants at the very smallest expenditure of toil. Where he multiplies, however, the British race begins to consider labour of all but the highest kinds dishonourable. And from the moment that a white population will not work in the fields, on the roads, in the mines, or in factories, its doom is practically sealed." I think that is such a key point. Like, that is such a quotable section of the book. Yeah. "From the moment that a white population will not work in the fields, on the roads, in the mines, or in factories, its doom is practically sealed." I think you could call that the Arrhenius principle.
Yes. Yeah,
Yeah.
such a good quote. Really, really drives it home.
Yeah, it's just so perceptive. Like, just reading this chapter, you just see so many things. You're like, Pearson was right. Like, people did listen to him, but obviously we didn't the lesson didn't really stick, because over time, I think, it kind of was forgotten. And I suppose we had the world wars, and I guess our attention was kind of distracted onto European affairs. But as soon as we hit the end of World War II, and you have post-colonialism starting to take off, and the British Empire is being dismantled under the newly emerging world order of the Americans and the Soviet Union, which both saw it in their interest, I suppose, at the time, to dismantle the old empires on ideological grounds, they kind of forgot this racial reality, that was preparing a new world order. Yeah, so I think ideology, really, like capitalism versus communism and all of that, was a huge distraction of this more from this more fundamental issue.
All right, Michael, I'll give your voice a break. I'll do some of the quotes. In the long run, the lower civilization has more vigorous life than the higher. The unprivileged gains upon the privileged class, and the conquered people absorbs the conquered. There is no perceptible trace of ancient Greek or Roman blood in Asia Minor or in Turkey and Europe. The Turk, himself a barbarian, has destroyed or driven out or depressed all the higher races he came across. And the population under him is now Syrian or Armenian, Albanian or Bulgarian. The Greece that has been restored represents a very small portion of the country in which Greeks were superior by numbers or by social influence and commercial activity. Under Alexander, or even under Claudius, in Transylvania, the Saxons are being crowded out by Romanians. And in Hungary, the Magyars and Germans can barely stem the uprising nationalities of Slavs and Romanians. In northern Africa, the Carthaginian, the Greek, the Roman, and the Vandal were successfully effaced. And until the French conquest of Algiers, the country was given up to Arabs of not a very pure breed, to the Berbers and to the Blacks. The Irish were reckoned by Petty in 1672 at 1,100,000 in their own country, and there cannot have been many outside Ireland. There are now probably 16 million to 20 million, counting only those who can be distinctly recognised as of Irish descent. Before the time of their great dispersion to America and Australia, they had increased within the British Isles from being about a sixth to being nearly a third of the population. Compare the increases of Sweden with a population of the highest type, at once warlike and industrial, during a rather long period, and it will seem very small indeed. Sweden, with its old province Finland, has increased at most fourfold, the Irish people at least 15-fold.
Yeah, nice quote. A bit of a diss here against the Irish and the Mediterranean and the Balkans.
Yeah, he gave everybody a little touch up there, didn't he?
I mean, you can see here that Pearson's thinking is kind of Nordicist, I suppose. You would say. Although I suppose that becomes more explicit in someone like Madison Grant or so on. But yeah, it's implicitly Nordicist here when you're saying that the higher types are, the Swedish, the Germans, and the Saxons, basically the Anglo-Saxons. So yeah, definitely not thinking of the whites as a unified homogeneous block, but within Europe he sees there being both higher type civilizations and lower type civilizations. And I suppose this gets into questions of R versus K selection and so on. I don't know too much about that. And, have you heard of that? The or that line that people draw across Europe where they, you've got the Nordicist countries at the top and they say, like, all the scientists have come from there or whatever. I'm betraying my my lack of interest or lack of great interest in scientific
No,
racism
no,
here.
no. I don't go in for like the haplogroup stuff, and it's that's out of my area of interest.
Yeah. Anyway, I think we can take the point here, and he's saying that lower civilizations or types or people who are conquered or underprivileged in general will breed faster, will increase faster than people of the quote unquote higher races. So
Yeah, well, that might come largely down to just being willing to accept a lower standard of living, and willing to increase in numbers in lower conditions.
yeah. So there are numerous, I suppose, interpretations that can be taken of this fact, but it is, I suppose, a fact. And he's applying this not just within Europe, but of course, the overall thesis is that the other races, the non-white races, will increase faster and thus will, in relative terms, gain greater power. You want to continue with the next one? Because then we go even from within Europe to within a single racial group, I
Yes.
suppose.
Yes. All right. Continuing the quote now. Now, if we inquire why it is that noble families die out, we shall find that the reason lies in the desire of all members to maintain themselves in the class that they are born into. It is an unwritten law that they must marry money or not marry at all. And the result is that when the heir to the title, marrying perhaps later in life, finds his wife sterile and a heiress, are the outcome of families that tend to be sterile. It may easily happen that his younger brothers have not married at all. Often, of course, it is not too late for them to take wives, but if they peer in possession, but if the peer in possession has daughters on whom the unentailed property will be settled, a man confirmed in his bachelor habits will often hesitate before he marries, only to continue the title. Now, it is the boast of the Englishman that our aristocracy is a supremely reasonable one, that there is no nobility clinging to the children of cadets, and that the highest peer marries freely into the commercial classes, and has done so for centuries past without requiring 16 quarters in a wife, or even two generations of gentility. All the more noteworthy is that family after family passes away as if it were laden with a mysterious curse. The instance cited above, which shows how few of our nobles are as old as the first Tudor, may seem an unfair one, as the 16th and 17th centuries were times of unsettlement when many families were deprived of the peerage by attainder or ruined by confiscations. An example from the comparatively modern times will therefore be more instructive. 155 peers were summoned to the first Parliament of James II in 1825. Only 140 years later, only 48 of these nobles were represented by lineal descendants in the male line. The family has, in several instances, been continued by collaterals begging the peerage, which they could not have claimed at law. And in this way, the change may seem less than it has really been. But the broad result appears to be that, left to itself from 1688, with new creations absolutely forbidden, the House of Lords would by this time have been practically extinguished. Of Charles II's six bastards who were made dukes, only three have perpetuated the race. Three peerages have been lost to the Howard family. Three to the Greys, two to the Mordaunts, two to the Hydes, two to the Gerards, and two to the Lucases. A religiously minded antiquary of Queen Elizabeth's time attempted to show that a curse attached to all families which had been enriched by sharing the spoils of ecclesiastical property. At the present day, we know that a normal percentage of those families is still enjoying the fruits of the parliamentary settlement, which it has pleased divines to call sacrilege. What was really valuable in Sir Henry Spelman's researches was the proof they afforded that men high placed enough to enjoy court favour are rarely the founders of long-lived families. It is in the lower strata of society that we have to seek for the springs of national life. That's reminding me of the Howzo situation, where you find people of means and good working class people aren't having children, while the lower classes, people who are living in the housing commission on the dole, appear to breed with reckless abandon.
Yeah, I mean, this was one of the main issues that prompted the progressivist eugenicists to sort of put forward their own views because, it wasn't really solely considered a racial problem, but it was often considered from a more class angle, like we don't necessarily want the criminal elements in society to predominate or to, outbreed the aristocracy and so forth. But yeah, I
Yeah, well,
think it, yeah,
it does
it,
raise the question, who is having children today in Australia? Like, who's having the majority of the children? And I think the answer would be immigrants.
Yeah, and the poorer families, I'd say. But I think, yeah, look, I mean, any aspect of human life is a matter of choice. I think we can say, obviously, people are driven by their instincts and by their, you could say, biological tendencies. But I think the important one of the important things to take away from Pearson is that we need to incorporate an understanding of these problems into ideology. And that isn't, that doesn't necessarily have to lead to what the average person, I suppose, is afraid of, which is this kind of negative eugenics that was a result of the first wave of this thinking, we could say, which is, the sterilization of people, the execution of people, and so on. I mean, I just don't think. And again, Pearson was ahead of the curve with this one, but I don't think there's a taste for it in our people, and I don't really consider it moral myself to, to take somebody and to forcibly sterilize them. I just find that incredibly distasteful and contrary to my own sensibilities, I suppose.
Yeah, but perhaps giving out
Yeah,
benefits to
that's
people
right.
in the form of,
Positive eugenics is I think, the way to go.
yeah, what I was gonna say was giving out benefit instead of giving out benefits or giving out welfare, perhaps a reduction of income tax would be a better incentive for people, because if you've not got a job. There's nothing really stopping you from having more children and collecting more bennies. Whereas if you are a working person, then you aren't entitled to all those benefits. Just a thought bubble.
Yeah, I mean that is kind of you could say the libertarian or the argument for libertarianism on the basis of what's the name of it? The what does Hopper call it? The time preference, right? So people with high time preference would be the poor who tend to, procreate the fastest because they don't consider the consequences necessarily of having sex now and having a child and so forth. They're just about the immediate pleasure of the sexual act or whatever, getting into those risky situations and then resulting in pregnancies and children and so forth. But I guess Hopper's point is that yeah, this welfare system incentivizes or supports people with that high time preference and penalizes people who plan longer term, like your aristocratic families in theory. And so it leads to this process of de-civilization, of civilization declining, because civilization can only occur when people plan for the future, make long-term plans, save wealth and then invest it carefully in different ventures that are going to be productive in the future. And those are all things that people with a focus on immediate gratification don't tend to get involved in as much, right? That's why they tend to stay poor and so forth. And I think that is, if we bring this back to the ANA, that's one of the very important things about our model is that it is a long-term model. It is a model where we say the association isn't just here for us, it's here for our children and our grandchildren, and that's the basis of our planning. And sometimes I might personally find that frustrating and think, why are we even bothering to think about, our great grandchildren or something like, can we focus a little bit more on the here and now? And there may be something to that as well. But look, I think it is important to have that long-term thinking, that generational thinking. And as you said, we need to find ways to create ideologies or educate people into ideologies that will teach people of a higher class, of a higher caste, we could say, I suppose, if we're bringing in the biological element, of course, it's more of a caste principle. Teach people of a higher caste to reproduce, even if it isn't their natural tendency. And it kind of sounds a little crude, I suppose, when we talk about, reproduction in this sort of way. But I mean, I think it is a great good to have a family, to have many children, to be married, and so on. So, I think it may sound a bit crude when we talk about reproduction in a biological sense, but it doesn't have to be.
All right, shall I continue the reading?
Oh, look, I don't think there are any other quotes here other than a recap of the first one that we did, because we're going to kind of bookend. Yeah, so yeah, look, we can reread that one in a second. Look, is there anything else you want to take out of this chapter? Because we have kind of read quite a few quotes from it. There is more in there, but I think it's mostly of the same sort of thing. I mean, he gives examples of South America, where the mixed populations have predominated, and the number of, I suppose, purebred white colonizers is a smaller percentage. So if we think of your Brazil, or when we talk about Brazilification in terms of Australia, it is a matter of there being a small minority of purebred whites versus mixed and pure Indian populations. So he gives that example. He gives the example of Russia and the struggle of Russia to fully populate Siberia and Alaska and so on. But is there anything else you want to take out of this chapter?
There was one more thing. I'll just pick out this quote. If we inquire why it is that noble families die out, we shall find that the reason lies in the desire of all members to maintain themselves in the class that they are born into. And I think this is something that we're going to see play out over, well, we're watching it play out now, where we're seeing children lose the Australian dream of owning their own home that their parents and grandparents had. And the younger people in this country are going to be subjected to a lower standard of living than what their parents had. And I don't know how people are going to take that. And just how that's going to play out on the political stage when people are struggling to make ends meet. And watching the grey nomads burn through the inheritance, especially as the boomers start over the next couple of decades checking out, and their power as a voting block starts to dissipate, what that's going to mean for us, I don't know. But it's just something that came out of the book that I flagged as being something that we're facing today.
Yeah, I mean, that is right. I mean, when we look at declining birth rates across the West, one of the reasons it's mentioned, I mean, there is, as one of our members wrote in an article, there's a large element of, I suppose, lack of support or lack of social status associated with being a parent, I suppose. So that is one thing, but a lot of people will say it is the people are delaying having children because they don't have that home ownership that's associated with that. So, of course, in the sort of Anglo-Saxon model of the family that has predominated in the US and in Australia, it is very much about, you become an adult, you buy your own home, and then you have your family in your own home rather than living in a generational household. And I think this is one of those things where we have to become accustomed to a different model of the family, and perhaps go against our instincts, because the main thing is that we are increasing our population, because the whole thesis of this chapter is, if your population is big enough, you basically can't be politically dominated. China's population at the time he's writing was so large that there was no way that the European powers would be able to exterminate them, even if they wanted to. So yeah, basically we need to populate or perish, I suppose. Yeah, we do need to live by that slogan, individually, as a group.
I'll let the missus know.
Yeah. That's the thing. Yeah, we do come from a population that is less inclined to have those larger families. So I think at the very least we needed to try and go by one for mum, one for dad, and one for the country. Otherwise, it's just stagnation, and I don't see how we can reverse the situation we're in. I suppose that's a very pessimistic take, in line with Pearson's own pessimistic thinking, where he says, the sole consolation that we can have in terms of our decline of power in the face of the rise of other people is that it was inevitable. So that, yeah, that's the very pessimistic way of looking at it. But if we can change our habits, change our culture, and I think this is one of those things where, you know, biology has an effect on culture, but I think it goes both ways. Culture will also, over time, will act as a pressure to select for certain other biological traits, I suppose. So culture can also change biology. So if we can change the culture, we may be able to sort of adapt our race. Yeah, that's kind of very speculative, I suppose, and far-reaching, but I don't know. What do you think of that, Trent?
Interesting point. I don't know. The thought that popped into my mind, I'm reading The Time Machine by H.G. Wells. I was reading it before bed last night, and in the future, the human race has split into two distinct groups, one that like lives above ground and one that lives underground. That was what I was thinking about when you were saying that. So I don't know what that means.
No, I'm not sure where you're going with that. Are you saying we need to like dig under the ground, and that's the true meaning of white laborism, and the true message of Eureka and so on, is that we need to live underground.
The diggers.
That's right, the diggers, the mole men. Mole man nationalism.
Was going with that either.
Yeah, no, unless we can be, I suppose, so extremely superior that, you know, one white man is worth, you know, 20, 30, 100 non-whites. Yeah, you can own the only other solution is to increase population. Yeah, okay. So perhaps that is a bit of a pessimistic ending, but it does suit the tone of the book. So do you want to read the famous quote that we started with that we're bookending with it then?
Sure. The day will come, and perhaps it is not far distant, when the European observer will look round to see the globe girdled with a continuous zone of the black and yellow races, no longer too weak for aggression or under the tutelage, but independent, or practically so, in government, monopolizing the trade of their own regions and circumscribing the industry of the European. When Chinamen and the nations of Hindustan and the states of Central and South America, by that time predominantly Indian, and it may be African nations of the Congo and the Zambezi, under a dominant caste of foreign rulers, are represented by fleets in the European seas, invited to international conferences, and welcomed as allies in the quarrels of the civilized world. The citizens of these countries will then be taken up into the social relations of the white races, will throng the English turf or the salons of Paris and will be admitted to intermarriage. It is idle to say that if all this should come to pass, our pride of place will not be humiliated. We were struggling amongst ourselves for supremacy in a world which we thought of as destined to belong to the Aryan race and to the Christian faith, to the letters and arts and charm of social manners which we have inherited from the best times of the past. We shall wake to find ourselves elbowed and hustled, and perhaps even thrust aside by peoples whom we looked down upon as servile and thought of as bound always to minister to our needs. The solitary consolation will be that the changes have been inevitable. It has been our work to organize and create, to carry peace and law and order over the world that others may enter in and enjoy. Yet in some of us, the feeling of caste is so strong that we are not sorry to think we shall have passed away before that day arrives.
Yeah, the eloquent statement of the boomer motto, I'll be dead then.
Yeah.
Yeah, not sorry to think we shall have passed away before that day arrives. Yeah, unfortunate, unfortunate, but prescient. So yeah, look, let's Let's put the call out. Like, if you don't want this to be the case, we do need to wake up, and we do have to find that we have been, to some extent, elbowed, hustled, and maybe not quite thrust aside yet. So let's perhaps we should look a little less to Pearson at this moment at the end of the podcast, and a little more to Barton, Deakin, Roosevelt, Madison Grant, Lothrop Stoddard, all those guys who said, well, actually, yeah, this is a huge problem, guys. We need to wake up to this. But it is not inevitable. It is not inevitable. We can change it. And if we look at our history, we did change it at the start of the 20th century. We instituted the White Australia policy. We had a mass deportation of Pacific Islanders. We got rid of the Chinamen out of our country. And look, if we can get these people out of here, then yeah, we don't need to have 50 kids each. we just need to be able to have enough strength to hold our borders. Perhaps that'll be a matter of creating nuclear weapons as a nation, and so forth. But yeah, I think let's end with a bit of optimism. It's not inevitable. There are things that we can do. But if you haven't organized yet, if you haven't joined an association like the ANA, well then you cannot complain when you find your pride of place is humiliated, when you are thrust aside, when you lose the things that you have worked for in your life. So I will say, join the ANA, work towards the mass deportation of foreigners, the ascension of our people again into pride of place in this continent. All right. That's it from me, guys. Let us know in the comments what topics you'd like to hear about from us, or if there's a particular topic relating to Australia or the ANA that you would like us to do a show on. As always, I'd encourage all our supporters in the audience to make sure you like, subscribe, and share our content far and wide. We'd love to share our show with as many good Aussies as possible. Lastly, if you want to reach out, you can find us at AusNatives.org. That's AusNatives.org. Thank you. Thank you.